when we protest on a Saturday, they're not even there. Be there. Every time fans get together for a game, they're already mobilized.
Yeah.
So now direct that anger to them and then go to the game.
Yeah.
And if they end up at the game, protest them at the game. These federation heads travel to games.
Amazing. And I mean, honestly, it's a no-brainer in a way. I mean, it's not just that there is a genocide going on. They're specifically targeting, you know, sporting facilities. 800 athletes in Gaza have been killed, have been murdered, you know. Why has it taken so long, Ashish? Why has this mobilization not happened earlier? Why are people not aware of these things?
Lack of radical imagination in some cases, I think. I think there's a twofold answer to that. I think you want to believe that there is moral. At some stage, something will kick in with individuals that they've seen enough, they've got to do something. But you have to look at the leadership of the West right now, and our governing bodies in sport are a reflection of that leadership. They're soulless. Like, they don't care about the value of our life, right? So if that is the top, we've got to be radical of how we use different tools and techniques and targets to get what we want to be delivered here, which is ending this genocide, right? And I think sometimes certain organizations move like oil tankers, and they're stuck on the path of a campaign that they believe in. But unfortunately, that campaign is never going to work by itself. So we're taking it one step further. I believe in that original campaign. But hey, it's not working. So now what else can we do? We take it one step further. That original campaign mobilized fans, got them to care about Palestine. But guess what? Now let's deploy the fans in a strategic way, in an actual strategic way, to actually get Israel booted out of football, get them boycotted by every European nation.
Do you think there's enough of the fans and, you know, the public in Europe to support this?
Yes. We don't need new people to join this movement. They're already there. You've watched us march in our millions, right? And you've watched football fans chant in their tens of thousands of stadiums. In fact, Paris Saint-Germain's fans, who I'm going to call out directly, started the chant about, you know, Nous l'enfant de Gaza. We are the kids of Gaza. We are the children of Gaza. Right? They've led that chant, and people sing it all over Europe, you know? And I think this shows you there's a deep connection, a deep solidarity with regular people. I think the problem with our movement so much is we obviously rely on celebrity to amplify something, right? And this is the case with many movements. Malcolm X always used to say that, you know, celebrities are puppets and can be controlled opposition. The actual power to make this happen isn't Mohamed Salah, isn't another famous footballer. The power to make this happen, what they're really scared of, is the people. And if the people are there every day outside that federation will buckle and break.
And when it comes to football, I mean, you can't overestimate, you know, the power of the fans who actually make football clubs what they are. Who else, Ashish, is involved in this campaign? You know, organizations, people behind it?
And people behind it, you know, there's amazing human beings behind this who've given up their time to work on this. But organizations, like we have the ADC in the United States, the Hind Rajab Foundation, you know, we have Code Pink. People who know how to organize, by the way. People who are doing radical things, like chasing, you know, IOF soldiers around the world. Shout out to the Hind Rajab Foundation. That is radical work. You know, we're not going to wait for an end of a genocide. We're going to do it while it's happening. We wanted to put a group together who actually have radical imagination and want to chase an end goal and actually deliver something. You know, the problem with some of our institutions in this space, they were built for a timeline that was slower, right? They were built on the models of apartheid South Africa. I believe in BDS, but the reality was that it was built in an environment where white South Africans were not exterminating the black population because they needed them as a labor force. The difference here is the Israeli occupation wants to exterminate every last Palestinian. And they're doing it at the quickest rate that they've done since the beginning of the genocide right now, because they've got it on multiple fronts. The starvation, the bombing, everything. They are killing people en masse, but we're operating like an oil tanker to stop it. So we need to be more radical, faster. The flotilla is a great example. That is commitment to change, you know. People trying to do all sorts of different things in Europe, like challenging embassies and ambassadors at this point. So why are they not doing something? That is radical attacks. We need to keep going down that line. We need to put pressure on individuals who have power to change things, right? We have the ability to change this. We need to shut down cities.
Yes.
Look at the French. Only last week they had a general strike. They're having another general strike this week, shutting down economies.
Yeah.
If we really want to do this, we need to be more radical. No more playing the long game, because there will be no one left to play the long game for.
Absolutely.
And the reality with this, this can work tomorrow. If we did this for 3 or 4 days this week, these federations will bend and break. And the ones who are Palestinian allies have no reason not to say they're not going to boycott. Calling out Norway here, calling out Ireland, calling out Belgium's now new government who's saying they support Palestine, calling out Portugal, Spain, Italy, who are the public, have been mass mobilized on behalf of Palestine, where unions are threatening national strikes. They are speaking for Palestine as we speak, and they will deliver justice. So those guys, take all those protests and anger at your federation, because they will break, because the public is on your side.
Some people might say to you, you know, you should not mix politics with sports. What would you say?
Muhammad Ali, sport speaks to the people. There's nothing else to say. What anyone not speaking out about the genocide in sport is a coward. You know, there's a lot of silence in sport. And it's, how are you not a human being? Also, what athletes don't realize and what they need to start realizing, especially in sports like football, is you're more powerful than the organization. Mm-hmm. They need you.
Yeah.
It is a disgrace that some of the most high-powered footballers in the world who control millions in endorsements and everything else, they're not going to take that from you. They need you. Mohamed Salah is a great example. The Premier League going to sanction him because he speaks on behalf of Palestine? Not a chance in hell. They use him to market to the entire continent of Africa.
Yeah.
Like, they need him more than he needs them.
Yeah.
And
bottom line is, this is all about humanity. You can't
separate
these different aspects. Mm-hmm. You know, politicians have been involved in sports. You talked of, the South African example. There wasn't the kind of lobby that is really, so the Zionist control. So this is not, you know, these are not separate components. These are all parts of what makes our lives.
Look, anytime there's war crimes, mass atrocities, genocide, you have to look at everything, right? It's not just about military and politics. Culture normalizes evil entities with us. And culture is where they should not be welcome as well, because you isolate them. They are a pariah. You have to isolate them. Sport is part of life.
You
have to ask why people divide everything. Why do they categorize everything? They do that so it's harder to actually change anything. In the end of the day, whether you're a footballer or a politician, you're a human being. Whether you're a fan or a union member, you're a human being. And if you care about other human beings, you should be acting right now, right?
So this, obviously, this is all about stopping the genocide, you know, and it's about Palestinians. But do you think this could be a crack for bigger things if we were able to succeed with this? Because there's a lot of corruption. There's a lot of power, like you say, controlled in football. But if this cracks, that there'll be bigger repercussion than just stopping the genocide.
I mean, my focus on this campaign is the genocide. And the goal is to make Israel, the Israeli occupation, as isolated as possible, to stop any form of normalization. Like I said to you at the beginning, football is the first domino. The Olympics will go. Other cultural institutions go. Eurovision is going as we speak. Art will go. Other things will go. If football goes, the cultural dominoes are huge. It's why you always go after what they invest in. You don't go after something they don't care about. The reason they invest so heavily in football is they know the domino effect. And we need to go after that with everything we have, because we know it'll topple a lot of other things. And if we do that, they will be isolated beyond measure. And then it starts to affect the economy.
Mm-hmm.
My only goal here is to stop the genocide, like anybody else I know who's working on anything right now related to Palestine. And if this puts a nail in the Israeli occupation's coffin, that's great.
What would determine, you know, the success of the campaign, and what's the timeline you're looking at?
We want them to act as soon as possible. There is no timeline. The goal is to have them kicked out tomorrow, yesterday, right? The success here is as many European nations as possible boycott the Israeli occupation's national team, their club teams, and ban their players from ever stepping foot in Europe again. And the goal is to have as many European nations do that. And we believe we can get 6 to 10 to go in the first couple of weeks, but it requires the people, because the people are the power. And when we start recognizing that, stop relying on celebritification or, you know, big social media accounts to do the work for us, we'll realize that we can change anything we want.
Thank you so much, Ashish. It's amazing that you are, you know, working on this campaign. And I'm sure, you know, everybody will support it. We, of course, will continue to monitor and spotlight this important initiative. thank you all so much for being with us on this special program. And once again, thank you again, Ashish, for both being the initiative and for sitting down with us to speak about this. Thank you. Goodbye.
Across the seven skies, see a pure heart never lies. The words you learn will never earn. It's time to think and wonder why. Stars above will always be a shining guide for us to see. And when I doubt, I'll have no doubt, but still I wonder why. Digging through our pages past, wondering how the truth will last. God's in control is what I found. I think I'll try this time around and know what really feels the path I seek. And no one's gonna care as much as unfold. Their glory is unique, we're told. The stories mark a precious past, but do we question why? A quest for truth can never be a lot I've faked inside of me. I walk in shoes I've never felt, only then I'll sure know why. They tell me just make up your mind, the path I see just needs a sign. The end is where I wanna be, which way I go is up to me. And no one really feels the path I seek, and no one's gonna care as much as me.
Good morning to all listeners from around the world. You are tuning to Iran Radio Broadcasting from Tehran. I'm your host for the next hour. Inventions that emerge from the Islamic world include the discovery of Critic Acid, Jaber ibn Hayyan, architecture, the minaret, the bridge mill, the vertical axle windmill, teaching hospitals, marching bands, early torpedoes, the guitar, the lute, the water pipe, also known as hookah, early attempts at gliding, algebra, the pinhole camera, the laws of refraction of light in optic, coffee, and more. Muslim scholar Ibn Haytham, known as Al-Hazen in Europe, who was born in 965 AD, formulated the scientific method and has been referred to as the world's first true scientist. He is also often regarded as the first theoretical physicist making a significant contribution to the theory of light and optics. Additionally, he developed what is called celestial mechanics, which led to the eventual work of Europeans such as Copernicus, Galileo, Johannes, Kepler, and Isaac Newton. You are listening to the continuation of Iran Radio. We start off this hour's programs with Round the World with reporters. Reporters from around the world tell us what is happening in their corner of the world. Listen to fascinating reports from countries both near and afar. After that, we have For a Better Life. The program teaches excellent practical ethics and morals which we can use in our lives from the point of view of Islam. Our varied radio productions feature will be our final program this hour. Stay with us for the next hour.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Sudan has condemned the latest Israeli attack on the Qatari capital Doha, calling it a blatant act of aggression. At the Arab Islamic Emergency Summit hosted by Doha on Monday, Sudan's Sovereignty Council Chairman, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, described the strikes as a violation of international law and a direct threat to regional security. Sudan declared full solidarity with Qatar, its leadership, government, and people, urging decisive Arab Islamic and international action to confront Israeli aggression.
Qatar has always stood firmly with Sudan and liberation movements across the Arab and Islamic world, especially Palestine. Al-Burhan's visit shows Sudan's clear support for Qatar against aggression. These attacks proved one thing: America is no ally, and Qatar is not standing alone.
Back in Khartoum, the mood reflects widespread support for Qatar, denouncing Israel's repeated attacks on civilians and critical infrastructure. The public rejects these acts of aggression and occupation, calling for accountability, justice, and a halt to violence.
We welcome Al-Burhan's visit to Qatar and strongly condemn the Israeli aggression against our brotherly state. We call on all Arab and regional nations to stand in solidarity with Qatar.
The Sudanese people affirm their full support for Qatar. We denounce Israel's aggression and extend appreciation to Al-Burhan and the government for responding to Qatar's invitation.
The Doha Emergency Summit concluded with a united front from Arab and Islamic states condemning Israeli aggression, which they said threatens global security. They also called for an end to the impunity Israel enjoys, emphasized the importance of upholding international law and supporting Palestinian rights. Israel struck a Doha residence last Tuesday where Palestinian negotiators were discussing a peace proposal for Gaza.
From Khartoum to Doha, Sudan's people and leaders unite with Qatar against the Israeli aggression. Their call is urgent: peace, protection, and justice for all civilians. Abdullah Hussein, Khartoum.
India's Supreme Court has struck down key provisions of a controversial new law that changes how properties donated by Muslims are owned and managed. The ruling follows intense debates and protests led by Muslims and opposition groups, arguing that the law infringes on Muslims' rights. They have welcomed the verdict, but say it is not enough.
I was expecting the court to stay the entire law, yet it's a good progress that it limited the powers the new law had granted in determining the status of donated property. We will continue our struggle for rights through legal ways.
The government says the new law called the Waqf Amendment Act 2025 makes managing Muslim-donated properties more transparent. Critics reject that. They say the law is a part of a broader political agenda by the ruling BJP party to marginalize Muslims.
There is a very high likelihood that the BJP will ensure that all Waqf properties are weakened. They will be rewarding encroachers. The result will be that the encroacher will become the owner of that property despite not having the title, because the Supreme Court, in its wisdom, decided that the limitation has to apply.
In Islam, a waqf refers to a charitable endowment made by people for the welfare of society. For India's Muslims, these assets hold great significance. That's because they support mosques, schools, cemeteries, and orphanages, and cannot be diverted for other purposes. Traditionally, their management has been regulated under the Waqf Act of 1995. However, in April, the government introduced amendments to the act, changing the process of managing Waqf properties.
Muslim groups allege the ruling party and its affiliates have promoted anti-Islamic policies since 2014, including communal violence, vigilantism, and demolition of Muslim-owned properties. They allege of being systematically oppressed through legislation such as the Waqf Bill to deprive Muslims of their donated land and to snatch their property rights under the Indian Constitution.
Activists claim India's Muslims face increasing intimidation under BJP policies that foster bias against minorities. The government denies this, insisting India is a democracy that guarantees equality for all. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
On Tuesday, some 5,000 people took to the streets of the Italian capital, Rome, to hold a rally in solidarity with the besieged Palestinians in the aftermath of Israel's ground invasion of Gaza City. The initiative was called by a string of pro-Palestine groups, including the Palestinian Democratic Arab Union, the Palestinian Youth Movement, and the Italian-Palestinian Association. The rally was largely attended by high school and university students who chanted slogans such as "We are all anti-Zionists" and "Long live the Intifada."
No agli accordi.
We say no to any form of military, commercial, and diplomatic engagement with a terrorist state which has been carrying out a genocide for 2 years, which has killed more than 20,000 children, over 60,000 people, and which has bombarded many West Asian countries. We must boycott terrorist Israel.
It's very refreshing, and it gives hope to see that the young people are starting to be aware of what's going around and to really express what they think. Because at the end of the day, it's the young, the new generation that is going to change the world.
People at the rally were bemused as to how Western countries haven't yet been able to impose sanctions on the Israeli regime after an endless list of war crimes committed in Gaza and in the West Bank since October 7, 2023.
On Tuesday, even Italy's Deputy Prime Minister and Foreign Minister Antonio Tajani said that Rome was opposed to Israel's offensive to take control of Gaza City, a statement that arrives in the context of almost 2 years of unconditional support from Italy for the regime by providing weapons, military training, and logistics.
Ha rappresentato una retorica di facciata.
It's Italy's usual rhetorical statements. There is no concrete actions put in place so that some real pressure is applied on Israel, with the goal to stop the occupation and the onslaught of Palestinians, which began long before October 7, 2023.
Two new large pro-Palestine demonstrations are slated to take place on September 22nd, when high school students will stage a nationwide day of strike against the Israeli regime's genocide in Gaza, and on October 4 in Rome. Max Civili, Rome.
After a three-year hiatus, the wheels of economic diplomacy are turning again between Iran and Pakistan. High-ranking delegations from both countries gathered in Tehran for the 22nd Joint Economic Commission, a two-day summit focused on deepening bilateral ties. Talks are co-chaired by Iran's Minister of Roads and Urban Development and Pakistan's Minister of Commerce and Trade. The commission is addressing areas ranging from trade and investment to transportation, energy, and even environmental issues.
We can say we have a common ground for joint activities in regard to facing the challenges, upcoming challenges, existing challenges of climate change, and also we can exchange experiences on what the two nations have done for managing their protected areas, their wildlife. And happily, we have a document that is going to be signed during this joint commission, and definitely it will be a step toward expanding our collaboration.
Discussions also cover the establishment of free trade zones and cross-border markets aimed at facilitating smoother transactions and boosting economic activity in border regions. Both sides see these initiatives as essential for regional stability and growth.
Iran and Pakistan's trade currently exceeds $3 billion, with Iran exporting $2.4 billion worth of goods to Pakistan in 2024. Both countries now aim to raise bilateral trade to $10 billion. Achieving this target will require adjustments in banking systems, easing trade regulations, and developing roads and infrastructure on both sides. Authorities from Tehran and Islamabad will work together to draw a roadmap to reach this goal.
This commission marks a turning point for Iran-Pakistan relations, with both sides seeking to overcome past challenges and create lasting economic partnerships.
As Tehran and Islamabad revive their joint economic dialogue, both sides are now aiming for a roadmap to boost bilateral trade to the $10 billion horizon. Yusumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
The main topic on the agenda of this year's conference is the June attacks on Iranian nuclear facilities and ongoing threats by the U.S. and Israel to nuclear security in West Asia.
International peace and security are indeed at risk. And we have seen this throughout history in particular, but not only, in the Middle East and dramatically last June in Iran, when its nuclear facilities were attacked. Together with His Excellency Dr. Araghchi, we signed an agreement indicating, summarizing the technical measures, the practical steps that we need to do to resume this indispensable work.
The General Conference started with the election of Iran as one of the 8 vice presidents with the support of the Middle East and South Asia group.
I would like to thank the majority of the members of the IAEA in this conference trusted Iran to be as one of the vice presidents of the conference, and especially I would like to thank our group, Meza Group, which entrusted Iran as a candidate.
Iran tabled a motion prohibiting any attack on nuclear facilities on Monday evening. The resolution is co-sponsored by Russia and China and will be debated on Thursday afternoon.
We ask countries to participate and vote to this resolution, because if they don't support our suggestion, it means that they are supporting jungle law in the force. So it is better to condemn U.S. and Israel and prevent further action as happened for us.
The Iranian resolution on the prohibition of attacks on nuclear facilities is based on common principles of the IAEA, such as the previous IAEA resolutions 533, 444, and the UN Security Council resolution 487.
Iran has put forward a draft resolution aimed at serving the international community. This draft resolution is firmly grounded in the perception of the mandate of the IAEA in full compliance with the statute and in adherence to the fundamental principles of international law and the Charter of the United Nations.
Islami also held bilateral meetings with the delegations of Russia, Venezuela and China.
This hall is divided between those who condemn attacks and threats on nuclear facilities and those who are joining the US, Israel and the E3 in their attempts to undermine the IAEA statute. But it's expected that most countries will support the Iranian resolution on Thursday. Dieter Reinisch from UN headquarters in Vienna.
For decades, the so-called two-state solution to the Israel-Palestine question has dominated Western diplomacy, enshrined in the controversial Oslo Accords of the early 1990s. 30 years on, many here say that solution was dead on arrival.
It's impossible now, in any event, even if it was desirable, which I don't think it ever was, to actually create a two-state proposition, because the West Bank, for example, has been completely atomized by the Zionist entity. So I think we need to rip that idea up and to start again. And what we're campaigning for is a one-state solution.
Critics of the two-state solution, now pushed for by Saudi Arabia and France at the United Nations, also pointed to Israel's ongoing genocidal assault on Gaza.
What they are actually doing is consolidating the gains made by the Zionist entity, which includes the absolute annihilation of Gaza, the continued terrorism that is being taken place by Israeli settlers in the West Bank. And what they actually want to do is consolidate the 80-odd years of Zionist settler colonialism.
The debate organized by activist independent movement grew heated, with some arguing for a state, including all Palestinians and those who live in what's now called Israel, if they wish to stay.
Every Palestinian should have the right to return. And Israelis who decide they want to stay will have obligation to assist the Palestinian to settle back to their home, and that means everywhere.
Opponents of that view argue it resembles South Africa after the end of apartheid, when many of the immigrant white population got to stay.
The concept of, you know, what is mine and what is yours is so simple, and actually people are trying to pretend there's shades of grey. No, actually it's very black and white. There's Palestine, and there's a fake terrorist construct called Israel that needs to be dismantled.
Dr. Ali also suggests that armed struggle by Palestinians is the only pathway to one state being materialized.
Armed struggle is legal under international law. And rather than, you know, and what we should be doing is arguing for deprescription of perfectly legitimate legal organizations under international law. We should be never condemning resistance.
At the end of the debate, it was obvious which motion received more support. With the Israeli regime openly rejecting Palestinian statehood as it commits genocide in Gaza, the debate here mirrors a wider global reckoning. The two-state solution has repeatedly failed. The consensus here, a one-state solution with equal rights for all the indigenous inhabitants of historical Palestine. Said Pour is up from Birmingham, United Kingdom.
This Friday, the quartet comprising the U.S., Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Egypt issued a joint statement declaring that Sudan's war has created the world's worst humanitarian crisis and threatens regional peace and security. The group called for a three-month humanitarian truce, unrestricted aid access, and a clear transition process towards civilian-led governance within 9 months. By Saturday, Sudan's government delivered its response. While stressing it welcomes genuine efforts to ease the conflict, the government underlined that no initiative will succeed unless it respects Sudan's sovereignty and the legitimacy of its national institutions. The statement also rejected attempts to place the state on equal footing with the militia, emphasizing that Sudan alone has the right to shape its political path during the transitional period.
The Quartet's statement have no legal or international legitimacy. They were formed to impose guardianship on Sudan. The UAE fueled and funded this war. Everyone knows who arms the RSF. These resolutions are worthless, equating the army with the militia, and each time the army advances, the Quartet rushes to rescue the UAE's spoiled child.
Khartoum also noted that international actors have struggled to enforce previous UN Security Council resolutions, including those on the siege of Al-Fashir. While the Quartet is pushing for a new roadmap, analysts point out that earlier efforts failed to deliver lasting results, leaving questions about whether this latest initiative will move beyond the statement of intent.
From Khartoum, it's clear the government is drawing a firm line, welcoming any support to end the war, but rejecting what it sees as outside interference that undermines Sudan's sovereignty. Abdullah Hussein, Khartoum.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio.
visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. He who honors his teachers sows seeds of wisdom that bloom for generations. Peace and blessings, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to For a Better Life. This is Nahid having the honor of hosting you on this episode, where we explore virtues that illuminate our path and nurture our communities. Today, we reflect on a profound topic, the respect and value of teachers in life. Teachers are not only those in classrooms, they are anyone who imparts wisdom, guidance, or moral direction. From our parents and mentors to scholars and spiritual guides. Respecting teachers is more than a responsibility. It is recognizing their sacrifice, learning from their insight, and honoring the knowledge they share. Saadi Shirazi, the Persian prose writer and poet, in the Book of Golestan, shares a story of a devoted student who sought knowledge from a wise master. The student asked, "Master, how may I repay your guidance?" The teacher replied, "Honor knowledge, act upon it, and teach it to others. And this lies true repayment." Here, Saadi emphasizes that respect for a teacher is inseparable from applying the wisdom they impart. The Holy Book of Quran elevates the pursuit of knowledge. Say, are those who know equal to those who do not know? Our Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam had said, seeking knowledge is an obligation upon every Muslim. Imam Ali alayhi salam taught us this way, that the ink of the scholar is more sacred than the blood of the martyr. These teachings reveal that teachers are vessels of knowledge and guidance, and respecting them is both a spiritual and social duty. Now, teachers can take many forms. The formal educators, like school and university teachers who guide our minds. Like the mentors and elders, those who share life experience and wisdom. Teachers can also be parents and guardians, our first teachers in morals, ethics, and faith. Our teachers can be our spiritual guides, the scholars and imams, or Ahl al-Bayt alayhim as-salam, who nurture hearts and souls. Every teacher deserves respect because their knowledge shapes society and molds the next generation. Now, what are some different ways to show our respect to our teachers and recognize their effort and their great action and their great effort, their great impact on our lives? We're going to discuss the ways that we can see and appreciate their efforts wisely and based on the Islamic teachings after a very short break.
ارتباطتون رو با خدا قوی کنید. در مسائل دینی به نقاط عقلانی و ظریف.
Improve your connection with God. Pay attention to logical and detailed points in religious issues and learn them from great masters. There are sentiments in religion, but they rely on deep ideality and deep thought. This thought must be learned.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Welcome back to the episode of Teachers on IRIB English Radio and, of course, For a Better Life. What are the different ways to show our respect and understanding of our teachers? Well, the first one can be listening to them attentively, showing that we value their words. We value every single word said by them. We apply what we learn. We should demonstrate that knowledge is not wasted. And of course, we need to express our gratitude. A sincere thank you or acknowledgement goes a long way. The other way can be avoiding the disrespectful criticism. We can ask our questions respectfully and with humility. The other way can be honoring their time and effort, recognizing the sacrifice they make for our growth. By practicing these, we honor both the teacher and the wisdom they share. Also, in one story from Saadi Shirazi, he narrates of a student who once mocked the master's unconventional methods. The student later realized that every lesson, though seemingly trivial, contained profound insight. In another narration of Imam Ali alayhi salam, he has emphasized, "Do not ridicule a teacher, for guidance is a gift from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and every guide is a messenger of light." These examples remind us that true respect involves humility, involves patience, and of course, reflection. Now, respecting teachers is not confined to classrooms. It extends to our daily lives as well. By just simply thanking a parent who teaches patience and morals, by valuing the mentors who provide career or spiritual guidance for us, by listening to the elders who share the experiences and caution, by supporting the educators, by sharing our knowledge responsibly, and by showing our characters, our role models in Islam, that we are going and we are at least trying to be their real followers. Through these actions, we create a culture of learning and moral growth. Now, let's ask ourselves these simple yet important questions about the teachers that we have had in our lives. First of all, who do we consider as a teacher? Have you ever acknowledged that your parents might be the greatest teachers with whom you started learning? Like the very first time that we were brought into this world and into this life, the first person that we saw was our parent, be it mom or dad. We just learned many lessons of life with them. Have you ever considered the Holy Book of Quran as the greatest guidance and light into our lives? Every time that we make ourselves more comfortable by just simply reciting one or two of the verses, we are seeing one of the greatest teachers of Islam. Have you considered those religious ceremonies dedicated to, for example, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, as the teachers who were showing you the correct way of life? Those reminders, the moments that we shed tears on the sad memories of Karbala, we were learning the lessons of life. We were paving our way towards the ultimate goal of just enriching our character and improving ourselves by just simply being in the moments of trying to understand and remember the stories of our prophets and imams. So this is very important. This is of high importance that we need to ask ourselves these questions. Who were my teachers? How has my connection to them ever been? How thankful have I been for the efforts that they have given and for the efforts that they have put into my betterment and into my personal improvement? And then, how can I improve my connection to the teachers in life and to those who have worked hard for the improvement of my personality and for who I am, and of course, the kind of person that I will be? Now, as we conclude, remember, every teacher, whether a scholar, parent, or guide, carries the burden of shaping hearts and minds. By respecting them, we honor the divine wisdom reflected through their guidance. Saadi wrote, "A mind enlightened by a teacher's counsel shines brighter than 1,000 unlit candles." Indeed, respecting teachers allows the light of knowledge to continue illuminating lives and communities. Dear listeners, let us carry respect for our teachers in our hearts, our words, and our actions. Listen with humility, learn with dedication, and honor those who guide us, for their influence extends far beyond the moment. May your path be brightened by wisdom. May your heart be softened by gratitude, your tongue gentle in thanks, and your words echo in every corner where guidance is shared. With that, I wish you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there. Be there.
You kill in the name of freedom. You kill in the name of democracy. You kill in the name of God. But not in my name will you kill. Is it not enough what you've done with all the bloodshed you've caused? Yet your greed drives you on. In your brutal race for acquisition, no land is left untouched. Driven by a vile ambition to have the whole world in your clutch. Every single new addition to your slave colony does nothing to dull your ambition to leave no nation free. It is indeed a sad condition that you suffer from, this itching desire for prime position to have all under your feet. Not in my name will you fight. Not in my name will you kill. Not in my name will you burn a child. Not in my name will you love. Not in my name will you invade. Not in my name will you lie. Take heed. One day you'll find yourself pursued by every person you've made bleed. You thought they'd been subdued. You were wrong. You were wrong. They've been freed. They've been freed. Against your evil methods of violence and intimidation, against your hijacking and misinterpretation of my peaceful faith and revelation, I shout with billions in this demonstration. Not in my name will you burn a child. Not in my name will you love. Not in my name will you invade. Not in my name will you pray. Not in my name will you dare to speak again. Not in our name.
Iran.
Baluchistan is populated by over 9,000 villages. The village of Ghalanor dates back to the Qajar period, and since this area isn't prone to earthquakes, these adobe houses have managed to survive for about 150 years. Isn't that amazing? About 40 kilometers from the city of Zobol, this village was originally built on top of a hill and witnessed the migration of the villages of Old Fort. In fact, that's where it gets its name, Ghalanor, which means new fort. Ghalanor was built on high ground to protect its occupants from flood, since the varying amount of the flowing water of the Hamul River has always caused different problems for the people living in the Sistan Basin. But that's not the only thing the architects of this village had up their sleeves. During the Qajar period in the 18th and 19th centuries, different regions were managed by overlords or khans. The most eye-catching structure here is the two-story adobe castle of the Khan of the region. It was built at the entrance of the village and around a small hill, so the top of the hill is the floor of the second story. The village is currently being restored and is going to be turned into an eco-tourism village. Two kilometers from Ghalanor lies a mysterious and ancient city referred to over the past 200 to 300 years as Dahaneh Ghulaman, or Gateway of the Slaves. Dahaneh Ghulaman is the largest Achaemenian site in the entire eastern section of Iran that has been dated back to between the 4th and the 6th century BC. More importantly, it's the only Achaemenid site that may hold within its depths the secrets of the lifestyle of the ordinary people living at that time. Built in the wilderness, away from the imperial capital, even with the alignment of buildings roughly in a straight line, running southwest to northeast along the edge of water supplies, the site was only inhabited for a brief period of a century or a century and a half, and was abandoned as a result of natural forces that have always determined the survival and migration of urban settlements in the arid region of Sistan. This entire site was covered by sand. After it was dug up about 50 years ago in the 1960s, the layout of this ancient city was studied extensively by archaeologists from around the world. And it seems that they all came to a similar conclusion. The precise architecture and great harmony in the design of Dahaneh Ghulaman suggest that it was built with urban planning in mind about 2,500 years ago. Geometric studies on this site have revealed 27 major structures and an additional 23 buildings, most of which have not yet been unearthed. It was believed that the Achaemenids used architectural plans only in the construction of palaces and important buildings, such as the royal residences of Pasargad, Persepolis, Susa, as well as Dasht-e Gohar. But it seems that the people of Dahaneh Ghulaman even prepared an architectural plan for the construction of their alleys and ordinary houses. The urban planning, the architecture, the temple, the location and size of what remains of this ancient city have led scholars to believe that it was a satrapal capital or something very similar to it in character. Studies into the origins of the hearths, fireplaces and altars have tried to reveal their purpose since they have a unique architecture. Were they used for animal sacrifices since animal blood was found on the altars? What kind of rituals were performed here? All these studies have tried to find answers to the many questions that arose 40 years ago with the unearthing of the site and have never been completely answered, even to this day. Standing atop the nearby hill that gives you an overview of the site, you can see lakes filled with a considerable amount of water around it.
The Chaimima reservoirs in the south of Zabul are three big lakes that are the second most important water storage reservoirs in the region. The water stored in these big lakes is used to irrigate the Sistan Plain and to provide drinking water for the cities of Zabul and Zahedan.
Trees were planted all around the lakes by the University of Zabul to prevent dust from falling into the water. This is Golnar Farnoudi for Iran.
As we continued our tour of Arras in northwest Iran, in the remote areas of the region, I found the opportunity to learn more about its history and its folklore. It is interesting to see how villagers in these remote mountains have managed to keep all their traditions alive, traditions that go beyond simple eating habits.
Games are an inseparable part of human culture. That's why as you study any ancient civilization, you will definitely find some very old games.
The village of Gulfaraj had its own museum of anthropology where I could find plenty of interesting information about the people that have been living here for thousands of years, including information about the local games that they played.
About games, most of us imagine a group of kids playing, but there are many games that even grown-ups can enjoy.
A game that is surprisingly reminiscent of baseball, making me wonder if this American sport actually originates in Iran. But anyhow, this game definitely encourages teamwork and requires a very fit body and healthy lungs. And as you can see, it is very popular among grown-ups. Even the elderly. Playing with knuckle bones, especially those of a sheep, is one of the oldest games that many ancient civilizations have in common. However, there are many different ways of using them. Most of the games are played by throwing them up and catching them in different manners. Again, another popular game among grown-ups as well as kids. Meanwhile, the dusty alleys of the village never seem to be quiet after school. The games are simple. You don't need anything special. A ball made of leftover bits and pieces of cloth and a few stones. Even a couple of pebbles are enough to keep the kids busy. And if everything else fails, there's always a song they can sing together.
Bandadusha is a popular game played by kids. It literally means capturing the violet, but I really don't know how it's played, which is why I'm joining them.
From what I learned, solidarity is the name of the game. One side loses when its human chain is broken by a member of the opposing team. And although they didn't use a sheep today, they still learned problems.